The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Some folks have come in since the handout. I may or may not have made enough copies, but if you're interested, there is a handout for this. It's got some really interesting quotes. I'll give you a hint. The first two are people we would probably disagree with about education, one of whom happens to be the U.S. Secretary of Education, so that might be a problem. And the other was foundational in basically setting up some of our public education system, so you can also see where some of those ideas might translate today. And the last ones, I think, are a little more inspirational. And Jonathan Kozel does know the difference between there and there. That was me misspelling it. So for those of you who are like, you know, grammatically perfect people, that was my fault if you found that typo. So I'd already made copies and decided to save some trees. Okay. So radical pedagogy, popular education, an alternate title for this talk could be How to Be a Marxist, Teach in Public Schools in America for 13 Years, and Not Completely Have Your Soul Sucked Out by Corporate Ed Reform. So you can see this is really personal for me. But by the fact that there are other people in this room, obviously there's some personal motivation in this room as well to talk about education, both its promise and its limitations, which is what I hope to address in this talk. So despite the fact we're discussing radical pedagogy, the format of this talk will mostly entail me presenting from the front of the room. So that's my disclaimer. With some breaks for social interaction with each other, so go with me. I do not believe in banking education, but I also want you to get your time and money worth on the last session of conference. So I assume you came to hear some information, and I want to provide that in the best way I can. If we had 3 hours, I think this would be structured differently, but we don't, so forgive me. And also, I have to give credit to Elizabeth Terzakis, who, raise your hand so people know who you are if you don't already. She inspired this talk and has given me some terrific resources for it, and it has been a pleasure to collaborate with her around issues of radical education reform, social justice unionism, and prayer. So just a shout out from the front. Next, who here is an educator? Please stand up. So get your bodies moving for a sec. If you're an educator, all right. Stay standing. Who may not be an educator by profession, but has ever taught anybody something, please stand up. So at this point, everyone should be standing, okay? Take a minute, say hi to the person next to you, and then have a seat. All right, so the fact that some of us teach as a profession and define ourselves as educators under capitalism because it is the work we do does not mean that we are not all educators. I'm gonna try to be careful about some of the terminology I use, and I'm gonna try to make a distinction between education and schooling and professional educators and those of us who educate other people, because we all do it. We've all been educated formally and informally, and I wanna address some of those things. We're all lifelong learners, and that is part of, you know, our immense capacity as human beings, that we can always learn new things. So we don't stop learning when we leave school, and we don't stop teaching if we're, you know, we're not, it's not that we're not teachers if we don't do that for a living. And I consider myself pretty lucky to get to teach amazing young people and get paid to do it. I don't get paid enough, but I do actually enjoy my job, and, you know, it's not all a terrible situation. So I want you to think about a wonderful learning experience that you've had in your life, either in school or outside of school, and I want you to tell somebody sitting near you about it. What did that experience entail? Were you alone? Were you part of a team? Were you given support from other people, or were you asked to do something completely by yourself? Did you really want to learn this thing, or was what you were being taught forced on you? Were you connected to the learning process, and did you see value in the learning experience? So most of us, since we shared a positive experience, I can kind of guess at what some of those answers probably are. Whether in school or in life, there are certain elements that are very common in positive learning experiences. When we're connected with what we're learning and we value learning it, when we work collaboratively with others as part of the learning process, and when we have time to practice and put what we've learned into real life experience, these are the situations where people identify successful learning experiences. And that's not me talking, that's like years of psychologists and people who have studied this. Now think about public schooling. So like, whoo, step aside. How many people here went to public schools? Woo, all right. How well did that experience that you just shared reflect your experience in public schooling? And so that's kind of where we're gonna to talk a little bit today about that possible disconnect. We must view education and schooling as two different things, although semantically they are used interchangeably under capitalism. I will try to be diligent about using the term schooling when I talk about the formal education process we subject young people to until they are exited. And education to mean broader learning and teaching experiences that we go through throughout our lifetime. So what then is the purpose of education? Notice I didn't say schooling. What then is the purpose of education? For some of you who know Freire, you might know what he would say. Paulo Freire, who is a Brazilian Marxist and educator, defines the purpose of education as connected to us figuring out our purpose as human beings. He calls this our ontological vocation, meaning what we do over the course of our lives to complete ourselves as human beings. The purpose of education is to facilitate and fuel that process. Again, this may not fit with what we have experienced in public schooling under capitalism, but that is kind of the broader definition I'd like us to hold a little bit around education. I want us to think about how this definition can inspire us to continue to learn and grow outside the confines of formal schooling experiences and help those of us who work in formal schooling experiences guide our practice. So here are the objective goals of this presentation. You can let me know at the end if we get there. I plan to give a brief overview of public education or public schooling under capitalism and how this places a limit on what reforms are possible on a pedagogical level. So I'm going to start with kind of the little more negative frame and get us to a little more positive place later on. Secondly, I'm going to discuss how a Marxist framework can help us examine what space there is for change in education and what we as educational activists can do. And then finally, I want to end by looking at some ideas from Freire, who I think has some of the best advice for us as educators that we can apply when we are teaching. Okay? So another disclaimer, it's impossible to cover well the history of education under capitalism and the many struggles for educational justice that has shaped it. I recommend two books for further reading that were foundational to this talk and also to that premise of surviving as an educator under capitalism. Schooling in Capitalist America and Education in Capitalism. Both of them are in the book room and they are both Haymarket books, so they're on discount, so please check them out. And now let's begin in earnest with some of these nuggets of knowledge that I promised to share with you. Okay, so this is a call out, so if you have an answer, you can just whoop, shout it out. What is pedagogy? You all showed up to this talk. What is it? Anybody?
The science.
The study of teaching, the art and science of teaching, teaching methodology. Okay, so you guys, wow. Merriam-Webster would agree with you. That is...
You've been schooled.
Nice. So the art and science of teaching and learning is a common definition. It's actually rooted in a Greek word called pedagogia, which refers to the education of boys in ancient Greece, which is interesting. It's a little nugget of knowledge. For Freire, the definition is a little bit different, though, than Merriam-Webster or the ancient Greeks. He talks about pedagogy not as a method or technique to be imposed on all students, but a political and moral practice that provides the knowledge, skills, and social relations that enable students to expand the possibilities of what it means to be critical citizens who participate in struggling for their own liberation. So one thing you'll know about Freire, if you've ever read him, he has long, complex, meaty sentences. It was all one sentence. Hopefully you took it in some chunks. It sounds a lot better than the Merriam-Webster definition. It also sounds very challenging for those of us who are teachers. The question then becomes,
who defines the political and moral goals of education and schooling, if that is what pedagogy is about, and what is our role in defining it for ourselves? So I want to show a diagram. Oh, if you didn't know, I like to bring charts.
So here's a diagram I think will help us understand the experience of students in school. Oh, okay. Well, I'll hold it up. Yeah. This is your job now. It's lovely.
So this is kind of like a hybrid of an Albert Bandura model about like spheres of influence, if you've heard of that. But I wanted to unpack this a little bit more and think about what a student experiences and where they interact the most in school.
So this little sick person is our student, and around them are teachers in the classroom, and then the school, and maybe the school district. Like, what are you? What kind of Common Core hellish curriculum are you doing or not doing? So those things influence the student very directly, and they're the most immediate experience. But then around that, we have family, friends, the community, the neighborhood, the attitudes about schooling. Are you getting educated at home? Does that contradict what your experience at school is like? Those things can interact. Then I have gender, sexual orientation, class, national identity, race. These are all things that affect your experience in school, but may not be as obvious to you when you're in the center of the learning process. These things are often less obvious. And then around the outside, as you can see, is capitalism. This is the thing we talk the least about, but has the largest frame and affects all of those other circles. So it kind of helps. Here's another metaphor if you're not a visual learner but a metaphor person. It's kind of like if you're looking at the stars and you're on Earth and you are looking at the stars and they look a little fuzzy. Like you can't really see them very well for a whole number of reasons. Light pollution, layers of the Earth's atmosphere which reflect light differently. You get a telescope, you can see a little better. The best place to see the stars is out in space, where there's no barriers to seeing what really exists. Unfortunately, we don't often get to directly attack capitalism and see it in its true form. What we see is filtered or refracted layers of it. And so this is why when we talk about school and school experience and personal experience, we all have differences. But at the end of the day, I would argue we are all under the capitalist system, and that affects us all in some similar ways, and that's what I want to start with. Thanks for holding that up. So I want to start with the role of education and specifically the role of schooling under capitalism. So Karl Marx writes in Contribution to a Critique on Political Economy in 1857 the following. In the social production which men carry on, they enter into definite relations which are indispensable and independent of their will. The sum of these relations of production constitutes the real foundation on which rise legal and political superstructures and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness. So basically, I want to unpack that and outline two key things I think he's saying in this quote. One, the process of social reproduction under capitalism is absolutely related to schooling, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. What purpose does schooling under capitalism serve in producing a generation of workers who hold certain ideas? Secondly, he's talking about dialectical materialism. The material part of dialectical materialism means that the type of society we live in, i.e. capitalism, which is based on one small class exploiting and oppressing the vast majority of us who are part of the working class, is the foundation for all the political, social, and learning structures that shape all aspects of our lives. So it's basically saying, because we're under that dome, it affects all of those layers in some way, and we can't opt out of it. So that's the material part. Class structures and exploitation permeate and are reflected in the superstructures which are formed to support capitalism, like the school system. These structures further the material and ideological interests of the ruling class. The dialectical part of this is that society is in a state of constant change and contradiction, and in order to understand these and use them to ultimately change society and get rid of capitalism, we need to look at the whole process and not just its disconnected parts. So I'm going to challenge us to try to operate between these layers and not get stuck in just one, and think about how these things impact and influence each other.
and contradict each other sometimes as well. Capitalist schooling often teaches students to look at the pieces as separate and disconnected. This is on purpose. This is even reflected in some of the theories of critical pedagogy, which I'm going to summarize later. But Marxism helps us see the pieces as reflections of the whole, and the small battles as part of a larger class war. Schooling is part of what Marxists mean by social reproduction. In other words, the structures and systems of public schooling under capitalism can best be understood in terms of capitalism's needs to produce the next generation of workers, to legitimize the ideology of the state that we live in as a quote-unquote meritocracy, which is the dominant ideology, and to further accustom young people to the social relations of domination of one class over a subordinate class in our economic system. So I'd say schooling does all of those things, and that's why it's so important to capitalism that schooling looks a certain way. Schooling plays both a practical and ideological role under capitalism. It teaches young people both the minimum skills required to be a good worker, like how to read, write, basic numeracy, and it, most importantly for capitalism, often teaches them their place in the world of class society. So this is who you are. If you want to get further and you don't, it is your fault. That is one of the dominant, think about grades, like just as part of that. That is why public schools and private schools that the ruling class sends their offspring to look so very different. The Sidwell Friends School in Washington, D.C., where President Obama sent his children, or sends his children, they have no tests or grades, really, until middle school. It has a profoundly different learning environment than most of the public schools that we work in or that we went to. Many students in our schools, starting in kindergarten, are subjected to up to 20 standardized tests a year. So no tests till middle school, 20. So clearly there's a disconnect. And I would argue it's, you know, there's a class-based reason for this. So I want to read you a little bit from the Sidwell Friends website, because it's fascinating. Since the founding of the Society of Friends, members have posed a series of questions or queries as guides to their beliefs and as a means to examine their lives and a way to measure their actions. These open-ended questions replace a formal doctrine or educational textbook and encourage ongoing personal reflection. For more than 25 years, lower school students have developed and written their own monthly queries for consideration of the community. These questions reflect issues and concerns relevant to their own lives, friendship, fairness, peace, understanding, nature and environmental issues, celebrations, differences, conflict resolution, service, and the world around them. The following are examples for community consideration from this year's class. In first grade, one of the queries was, how do we keep greed from growing in an I want everything world? I'm not sure how well these kids learn this lesson because many of them go on to be not so concerned with greed, but it's fascinating. I was like, whew. In the third grade, they looked at this question. How can we learn to see and appreciate the beauty of everyday things around us? So not here is the textbook from open court that will suck the soul out of your educational experience, and you're going to have to read this story 8 times and then take a quiz on it on Friday. So learn it. How do we keep greed from growing in an I want everything world? Discuss. I mean, like that, it's a totally different framework. So looking at schooling this way can make me sometimes want to throw up my hands and be like, well, I'd love to get a job at Sidwell Friends School. Not that they would hire me after this presentation. But I think it also shows us that education, there is some, there's some real contradictions, and just talking about them and exposing them is the first step in this process. So let's get some more bad news out of the way while we're talking about schools that working class kids attend. Just lay it all out there. We're up against the school system that is one of the most developed aspects of the superstructure of capitalism. I would argue in the past 30 years since the publication of the infamous A Nation at Risk and the beginning of the backlash against the American working class, the viciousness of the corporate attacks on public schools have massively increased. So the schools we are working in now are different than the schools some people may have attended. Thanks. The attacks on teachers and students, coupled with the vast amounts of privatization and profiteering that has occurred on the backs of poor students, makes it seem like we are in an economic and ideological battle for the very soul of public education. And it feels like it's going to be really hard to win. So just that's some more bad news. This is true. We cannot completely transform education into the kind of vision Frere or Sidwell Friend's school had without completely, ultimately, I would argue, overthrowing capitalism. But that doesn't mean there isn't real space for change in the here and now, and real things that can get us closer to where we ultimately want to be. So here's some good news. For all of its efforts, capitalism has yet to fully squash some of the liberatory promise of education. So despite all of the bad things we know about public schooling, people still look to education as a way towards liberation. And that's important. One has only to look at the number of civil rights struggles and working class struggles to fight for educational equity to see how this is a real demand for people in our movement. National polls consistently show education as a top issue for likely voters, with people overwhelmingly saying schools should get more money and should have more local community control, and families overwhelmingly say they love their kids' teachers. This was a Gallup poll, it was done in 2014. Everything that we've heard them say about schools, actually most people don't believe it. So there's something there. There is something there. Despite the bad teacher narrative, families love their kids' teachers. This is part of that dialectical contradiction we talked about earlier. This is the space where we stand and fight. In 1869, Marx wrote, "On the one hand, a change in social circumstances was required to establish a proper system of education. On the other hand, a proper system of education was required to bring about a change of social circumstances. We must therefore commence where we were." So this idea of like, we need to fight where we're at, we need to understand the big picture, but now I'm going to get into some of the more hopeful stuff. Therefore, we will now shift from what is done to us through schooling and what we can do to change it. So back to the diagram. The areas in which we have the most control right now are those ones closest to the center. But I will say that they are intricately related to the things around them. And the more we fight in the center, the more we and are conscious of the outside, the more we start to get at it. So I would say commence where we are, but continue to fight. Okay, so critical pedagogy theories, I want to talk a little bit about them. Because that's kind of the title of this talk. It was radical pedagogy, and then I was like, oh, the Academy calls it critical pedagogy. So I read some critical pedagogy theory. There's a lot of individual solutions proposed, and what I found was a lack of kind of ideological solutions. There's a lot of systemic analysis, but a lack of collaborative, collective solutions. So it's really interesting because you can read these really great analyses that talk about the system and the problems with the whole thing, but then the solution is very oriented towards an individual or a changing of a mindset or what you can do by yourself as opposed to a collective solution. So I'm just going to point that out because I think that's some contradiction and something we have to keep in mind when we look at these theories. I actually made a diagram as well. It's two-sided, so I'll hold it up. So I'll actually stand up and hold it up. So this is my visual summary of some of the critical pedagogy that I read, which is you have an individual, either a teacher or a student, and then you have them interacting with these different things. And if you notice, the arrows are kind of going one way, like you can have a good analysis of this or this or this, but they're kind of separate. They don't overlap. It's kind of a one-way street. Sorry, this was done this morning too, so you can give me some time. And then this is what I actually think the picture really looks like, which is very messy, very messy. And you're not alone. There are other people. And even though you may not have the exact same experiences, you can have a collective project to change things. And these things all overlap. And sometimes they come together and sometimes they're separate. And there's arrows going both ways. This is that part about dialectics. we are changed by the world we live in, we also change it and then are changed by that, and there's this back and forth. So this is my kind of response. Not that it will ever get published, but it's not a neat little box where we can talk about each of these separately. And that was my biggest criticism of some of the critical pedagogy theories. Okay. And one of the ways we consolidate learning is by discussing it with other people. And that's very basic, but really, really important, and something we don't often do enough in education or in schooling. Sorry. So I want to give a kind of a brief summary of some of the critical pedagogy. Sorry, that was my timer. Critical pedagogy theories that I read. There's some good stuff in there. And one of the really important things that critical pedagogy has lent to the teaching profession recently is that it asks us to seriously examine the world we live in, the world our students live in, and seeks to bring an analysis of that into the classroom through dialogue and culturally responsive practices. I would say that is an advance for education, that we talk about things like cultural responsiveness. I don't think that's the end all be all, and I think there are some problems inherent in some of those theories, but it's a good place to start. The problem is that many of these critical pedagogy advocates start with the system and an analysis of the larger forces at play in the classroom and in schools, but then focus mostly on the role of educators and classrooms within it as the vehicle for change. This is a recipe for burnout and moralism, not for actual system change. And I think that is what we've seen happen to a lot of our most enthusiastic young teachers, in particular teachers of color. They go in trying to change the world in their classroom, and they can't do it, and they leave. And that is extremely sad. It's something we've seen a lot in California. Along with the neoliberal attacks on education, I think it is something we have to grapple with. Education alone will not be enough to change society. It will require an actual movement in the streets and workplaces that goes beyond the walls of the classroom. And simply changing people's ideas is not enough to change the world. It is a start, but it is not the end. I want to just take an aside to talk about critical race theory, because there was some very interesting stuff in there. I can't give it due justice, but I think some folks were here this morning for the discussion. One place I did find some really interesting articles was from Gloria Ladson Billings. I don't know if people are familiar with her and others. They've put out some really interesting ideas about the connections between racism and institutions like public schools. And they go beyond just changing ideas about racism to attacking the very structures that prop up institutions racism in America. So they actually do have a little bit more of a structural analysis. The history of racism in schooling and the battles against it have been critical lessons for us and our students, and I would argue should be part of a critical curriculum. Bringing conversations about structural racism into the classroom, especially in a moment where we see Black Lives Matter happening around us, is important and essential. Ladson Billings raises also some interesting ideas about things like property rights and the connection to what is considered knowledge, which I found really interesting. And if you want to talk more about it, buy me a coffee and we'll talk later. Or read more about it. You know, there's some really interesting stuff. I don't have time to give it what it's due in terms of a proper discussion. There's also some really interesting discussion about desegregation. Desegregation versus educational equity, how there can be desegregation without educational equity, and how the resegregation of schools has shaped the conversation around educational equity. So if you go into most urban school districts, the schools are actually pretty segregated. You know, mostly students of color attending urban schools, and you know, the conversation about just access to education doesn't go far enough to really look at what racism does to our public schools. Another interesting place where I think there have been some really positive contributions on the question of critical pedagogy is in child development and how we think about young people. And this is something I'm very passionate about. So how we teach children and basically the idea of like who are young people. There's been a lot of advances in developmental psychology. In particular, there's a guy named Dr. Dan Siegel. He's written a couple of books about how the brains of young people work that can help us teach them better and also have some respect for the amazing things that happen during a young adult's time in school. Unlike Piaget, who argues things like before the age of 7, students cannot grasp abstract ideas. Like, I mean, like, these kind of, like, until you are this old, you cannot get this. Like, it's not, we all know people are different. And people's minds, you know, like, people's minds are different. Siegel paints a picture of children and adolescents as very capable beings with much untapped potential for learning and processing information. Think about something like the acquisition of language and the immense intellectual capacity a young person under the age of 5, most likely, must have in order to learn to associate abstract words, letters, and symbols with sounds and then with objects, and not even objects, ideas in the world around them. That is tremendous. And as human beings, it's something we all do. So our brains are capable of an immense thing. This doesn't mean go read Fahrenheit 451 to your kindergartner and they'll get it, but it means we should think about this when we teach young people and what they are capable of. And that we shouldn't shy away from teaching students to, quote, read the world, as Frere says, not just a primer. Dr. Siegel, in his recent book, Brainstorm, explores, and I'm referencing it because I think it's in the Haymarket Book Room, explores how young people's brains work and what we can learn from them, meaning what are the aspects of adolescence that we should not scorn or fear, which those of you who have taught middle school may have, like, oh, middle school. Like, I mean, like, that's the first response. What grade do you teach? Seventh grade. Oh. Like, wow. Like, you're my hero. Like it's going into battle or something, right? He says you should not scorn these things, but rather nurture them and use them to get students excited about learning and self-discovery. Particularly like this book because it talks about the ages of students that I work with, preteens and teens. He discusses four amazing things that are happening when young people's brains are developing into adulthood. Novelty seeking, which is the motivation to try something new. They are risk takers. Social engagement and deeper connectedness with peers. They're not just totally into themselves. And I will say there are some kindergartners who are like, whoa, school, I have to share. Like, there's a little bit, you know, there's some amazing things that happen connecting with your peers in a school environment. The increased emotional intensity of adolescence, so feeling things very deeply, and creative exploration and innovation coupled with an expanded sense of consciousness of your place in the world. Those are amazing things that we can use as educators when we work with young people. This means rather than young people being unprepared to talk about big ideas, they are ripe for those kinds of discussions. Teaching about real world issues is one way to actually engage young people more. Anyone here engaged in an intractable argument with a young person where the claim was made, that is not fair? Like, raise your hand if someone's, I mean, if you teach, that is like, that's not fair. That's not fair. That comes from this sense of, like, there is a just and an unjust. That is fair or unfair. We should talk about these things. Okay? The sense of justice, wanting to make the world a more fair place. It has not yet been compromised out of them by capitalism, which I will say does happen to some people later in life. You start to believe the world is unfair and there is nothing we can do to change it. I do not see that in most of the young people I work with. It can be exasperating to have the fair conversation, but I say we should cherish it and use it. So I'm going to end this talk with a brief discussion of Frere's ideas because I think they're the best kind of tools for us to get at some of these bigger ideas and beliefs about young people and education and its potential. The starting point for him flows directly from the idea of who young people are, because he talks about people should be empowered by the learning process, not cowed by it. So capitalism wants to cow people in schools, and we want to empower people. Okay, so that's the fundamental difference. Education should be a means not of subordinating people and making them feel powerless and disconnected with big ideas, but rather giving them the tools and the confidence they need to make a difference in the world and work with others to do so. This is certainly connected to how we view young people and their capacity to change the world. So Frere's idea on pedagogy. How many people here have read Frere? Okay, so Pedagogy of the Oppressed, great book. I needed to read it like 3 times, so it's not like, oh, you're gonna read it and you're gonna get every answer that you ever needed about it. I actually found another one of his books called Critical Pedagogy, where he talks about teaching literacy to Brazilian peasants and workers. Very interesting, because I actually had like examples of some of the discussions and things that they use to teach, and also some real life feedback from the students about what they liked about that. So that's another one. I read it for the first time for this talk and found it interesting. So the key starting point, and I'm gonna kind of go like small to bigger with Frere. One of the key starting points is that learning should happen through dialogue and interaction. I'd say that's foundational to all of his teaching ideas. Human beings' ability to reflect, not just act, is the foundation for Frere and how learning should happen. Praxis is the term for this process that he gives of action and reflection, which facilitates learning. So praxis is action, and I probably should have had this on a handout, but I will. As educators, giving students space to reflect and tools to help them do this is a critical way to solidify learning. So you gotta have dialogue, no sage on the stage stuff all the time. If you've heard that term, nobody, I guess, like, come on. Okay, so Frere also believes education should entail the examination and interaction with what he calls generative themes. So he gives us some of those like big ideas, that looking at the larger part of the circle, even if we can't directly get at it. Frere states that every epoch in history, quote, is characterized by a complex of ideas, concepts, hopes, doubts, values, and challenges in dialectical interaction with their opposites, striving towards their fulfillment. So there are generative themes in our epoch. Anyone want to call out some of what you think might be the things that, hopes, concepts, ideas that are, don't be shy. Oh my God, no one's talking.
Equality.
Equality.
Justice.
Justice. Social justice. Tolerance.
Violence.
Violence, yeah. You know, oppression. Meritocracy, we talked about that earlier. Competition. I mean, they're good and they're bad.
Evolution.
Evolution.
Health.
Okay. Health. All right. Racism. Sexism, you know, like these are all things that kids grapple with and ideas that we should be bringing into our classroom.
Cognitive dissonance.
Cognitive dissonance. Empathy.
Family issues.
Family issues. All right, so think back to some of those big questions that the Sidwell Friends people are working on. Those are kind of generative themes, right? So there are some schools doing this. This should be part of all school curriculum, I would argue, and all students should have space to grapple with the challenges of the real world in which they live. I don't think there's anything better you can do than bring some of those generative themes in whatever way possible, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples in a minute into your classroom. So the ultimate goal of this kind of education is what Frere calls conscientization. God, he's so good at making up large words. It's actually different in Portuguese, and I'm not even going to attempt to say it as he originally wrote it. That's the English translation. It's a process of developing a critical awareness of one's social reality through praxis, that action and reflection, and interaction with generative themes. This is how people who live in a capitalist world can begin to break with the dominant ideologies of society. Notice I said begin to break. This is not an automatic, you teach a really great group of kids and they leave Marxists. It doesn't happen that way. But it's the way we start to begin to chip away at that outside. It's like the telescope you use to see the stars more clearly. You're still on Earth, you're not in space, you're not out there looking at them directly, but you're getting a better, sharper picture. We all acquire social myths and bad ideas from capitalism, but learning can be a critical process where we uncover the real problems and actual needs in society. Through this experience, we're able to clearly see the contradictions inherent in capitalism, and our ideas and consciousness can begin to change. Obviously, we cannot completely structure all of our classes, those of us especially who work in public schools, to be run in a Frerean model. Although anyone here work at Sidwell Friends? You might be close to that. I don't know, I've not been in those classrooms, but it looked pretty good. However, keeping these concepts in mind, we can certainly structure our classrooms to help empower, not denigrate young people. We can create spaces for students to grapple with big ideas, have dialogue with each other, and learn how to reflect and act to change the world around them. Highly recommend it. And then Pancho Rabbit and the Coyote is about a migrant's journey across the border, and the coyote who doesn't have his best interests in mind. So, you know, there are good things out there. I'm gonna be quiet now and let people participate in some discussion in the time that we have left, and hopefully people will feel free to share some of those own their own stories, ask questions, and be part of this dialogue. So.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.